Blog Talk Radio.
The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and once again I'd like to welcome our listeners to Left Turn with Stuart Alexander. And once again we have Al Suarez. He's joining the program. Once again, he has actually become a regular to the program where he helps to analyze and discuss many topics that are relevant to the left. And Alex, Al, once again, I'd like to welcome you to the program today.
Thanks for having me, Stuart. How are you doing?
Good. Al, I see you post stuff all the time on Facebook and on the Internet, and I can see that you really stay on top of events that are going on around the world, and I thought you'd be very the right person to discuss this topic today. Is it time to rethink the nuclear fallout shelters? And that's our topic today. Is it time to rethink the nuclear fallout shelters? Al, let me ask you, what do you know about the history of fallout shelters when they started that program back in the mid-1950s? What do you know? Because a lot of our listeners are in your part of your generation, and myself, you know, myself being 63 years old, you know, I have lived through that period. But what do you know about fallout shelters yourself, Al?
Well, before I get into that, I just wanted to give a shout out to Dean Capone. I got to meet with him down here in St. Petersburg, Florida, the other day, and as you know, he's running for president with the Socialist Party of USA. And, you know, my mother went through that, you know. My father, no, because he's, you know, Peruvian and he didn't immigrate to this country until 1981. But my mother went through that growing up. She was born in the early 60s during the Cold War. Her father was abroad. He was part of the National Guard and he was in Europe. She was actually born when he was abroad. You know, she described to me growing up how scared she was of the Soviet Union, how they really instilled that fear, because that's really how they control the populace, like they do today with the terrorists. They control them through fear, and how, you know, they trained them in the public schools, you know, how to hide underneath the desk and things like that in case there's a nuclear explosion, and people had fallout shelters in their basement and survival, you know. They went and stocked food and, you know, it helped benefit the grocery stores. And, you know, so that all that is just a product of fear, you know. And I'm sure that Russia also at that time, the Soviet Union, had their own fallout shelters as well. And you hear stories about rich people in this country who are building bunkers.
Right.
They're preparing for chaos, much like you see going on in Ferguson. So, you know, you have rich people that, you know, in case this does happen and all hell breaks loose, they have their supplies, they have their bunkers down there where they can go and take shelter and live comfortably while there's chaos up above, you know, here. So.
Well, you know, what I remember the nuclear fallout shelters back in the 1960s, and it was especially around the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, because everyone thought that we were right on the verge of going into a nuclear conflict between the Soviet Union and the U.S. But what I can remember, especially being in elementary school back in the 50s and 60s, where they would tell you how to duck and get underneath the desk, and then after the initial explosion or blast, then you're supposed to seek shelter by going to a designated fallout shelter. And at that time, you would see the yellow and the black symbol sign where you would know that that would be a protected, a protective site, where location where you could go underneath the ground, such as a basement. I went to George Washington Carver Elementary School and also Second Street Elementary School here in California. But I remember distinctly there in Virginia, in Newport News, Virginia, at George Washington Carver Elementary School and also George Washington Carver High School, they had fallout shelters underneath the where the classrooms were, where you could go into a basement.
Wow. Yeah.
And you could be protected. You initially you would get under the desk. We would do these drills, and after you get under the desk, you could go into the basement, which would give you additional protection because obviously you had concrete that would be over you to protect you against any type of fallout. In addition to that, when you would go to, and I can remember like downtown Newport News, Virginia. I can remember when I lived in Michigan at the time, certain government facilities, county buildings, city offices, they would have that same symbol, the yellow and the black symbols on the buildings where you knew that they were fallout shelters. So anywhere you would go, public facilities, well, within metropolitan areas, you would see this.
Right.
Also, what you could see in the 60s, President Kennedy, he started supporting the program where people, they had government monies that would help people to build fallout shelters right there at their own home. In their yards, in their basements. And you saw even in many of the metropolitan areas around the country, they were doing the same thing. This is something, Al, that was being done because there was a looming threat of war between the Western powers and the Eastern powers, being the Soviet Union and the United States. At the time, we saw the Soviet Union, or I should say we perceived the Soviet Union as being an aggressor. Today, we see the U.S. as being an aggressor in world affairs. We see the threat of war looming every time we read something on the Internet. Forget about seeing anything on the television, because the television is telling you everything is all right. When you open the newspaper, say Russia is starting another conflict. They are creating more chaos here or there, whether it's Iran or whether it's Syria or whether it is Crimea or wherever it's at. But they always paint Russia as being the aggressor. But when you look at what has taken place, Al, and what we're talking about today, all these events are creating a situation where it could lead to war. And the people of this country in the U.S. are not prepared. You know, usually what you find, Al, is if you keep preparing for war, chances are you're going to get it, you know? And that's the history of the world. But do you have you – and Al, what year were you born?
84, just like Orwell, right? This book, 1984.
A lot of this, what was taking place as far as in Europe, it was just before you were born in 1981 and 86 in parts of the world such as Switzerland, in Finland, Norway. In that part of the world, they have already, even then, they were still preparing in the event of a nuclear disaster, how the people of those nations can be prepared. But anyway, what are your comments on that? Because I just want to find out, what do you know of other nations preparing for these type of events?
Well, first I wanted to get into my father's a year younger than you, Stuart, so he's old enough to have served in Vietnam towards the end in the early 70s. But because he wasn't, born in this country, he wasn't in the country at that time, wasn't drafted. But he could have very well been. People from his generation, from his age, a lot of them were drafted and perished. And that was also during the Cold War era, but that was more of a hot war, that part of it, in Vietnam.
Right.
And while you were describing the situation, the Cold War was making me think of when they tell how the United States was making fake military bases throughout the country so that when the Russians, from their satellite in space, spied on the United States, that they would think that they would have to build more military bases so they would bankrupt themselves. In the end, you know, the space race and all this military expansion, instead of denuclearizing, which is what Khrushchev and Kennedy tried to do, but, you know, the Cold War after Khrushchev left and after Kennedy was killed was escalated. And ultimately Russia bankrupted itself, you know, building more and more military might. And now you have the United States in the past, what, 10, 15 years has doubled its military budget.
Yes.
Now 60% of the national budget, billions of billions yearly of dollars, mostly military aid, is going to Israel that doesn't need it. It's the number four military power in the world. So the United States Empire is bankrupting itself in a similar fashion that the Soviet Union was. So if there is a collapse, like I said, the rich are preparing for it. They're building bunkers and things like that. As for fallout shelters in other countries besides Russia, I'm not too familiar. I know during the Cold War, the Russians had their own fallout shelters as well. They were expecting the possibility of a nuclear scenario as well, which would be quite disastrous. I think the other day when I was on your program, I mentioned the Einstein quote that when they asked him what weapons would be used in World War III, he said, "I don't know what weapons would be used in World War III, but I know World War IV would be sticks and stones," right?
Uh-huh.
Because there wouldn't be anything left. And a lot of people blame unfairly Einstein, who was a civil rights activist and a socialist. They blame Einstein for the Manhattan Project, which ultimately brought about the nuclear arm. But what they don't know is that he was not involved with the Manhattan Project at all. They didn't even consult with him. They just used his work without his knowledge to contribute towards the Manhattan Project, which is why when he found out about that, he was very angry, and he made a lot of comments publicly, you know, for pacifism against war. He was an admirer of Gandhi. So, you know, there's the myth of Einstein and there's the real Einstein. You know, Einstein was an activist himself. You know, he escaped persecution from the Nazis. So,
right. You know, what I'm looking at, and I'm just reading about the history of these fallout shelters, Al, I'm seeing that during the Cold War, many countries built fallout shelters for high-ranking government officials and crucial military facilities such as Project Greek Island and Cheyenne Mountain nuclear bunkers. But when I see this, mm-hmm. even in Canada, in throughout the United States, throughout Germany, they are still preparing for war. And I read here it says Switzerland built an extensive network of fallout shelters, not only through extra hardening of government buildings such as schools, but also through a building regulation that ensured that all residential buildings built after 1978 contain a nuclear shelter able to withstand a blast of a 12 megaton explosion at a distance of 700 meters. In addition, the Swiss government maintained large communal shelters, including the Sonnenberg Tunnel, stocked with over 4 months of food and fuel. But, I mean, here, and they say the reference nuclear war survival skills declared that as of 1986, Switzerland has the best civil defense system, one that already includes blast shelters for over 85% of all of its residents. And you look at some of these other countries when they are building such as transportation, making transportation investments in their economy, when they're building such as subways, mass transit. They are building systems where they can provide some type of civil defense system. France, you see it happening in Germany. You see it happening in the United Kingdom. They're doing that. But it's like they're preparing, you know, their countries, their citizens for this event. And as I mentioned, Al, we're not doing anything of this sort of preparing in this country. What are your comments on that?
Well, let me ask you this. Do you know what's the third most armed country in the world?
The third most armed country in the world, I would say, is, China?
Nope. I'll tell you this. It's Switzerland, and that's after Yemen and the United States.
Third most armed. Now, how did you come up with that? Because
well,
I had to do a little bit of research.
And also Switzerland.
Because you know which country spends more on armament than the U.S., the second to the U.S.?
No. I'm not talking about the government. I'm talking about the people because they have a tradition.
Oh, you're talking about the people. Oh, okay.
Yes.
The people.
I'm talking about the people because they have a tradition there of training their children to use weapons. And the people have more guns there than any country. Yemen has several because they have tribes that are very armed. And, of course, the United States because we have very loose gun laws. But Switzerland's the number three and the amount of guns that people have. And they're also the country with the lowest crime rate. So, Switzerland, a lot of the deaths, the gun deaths in the United States are not necessarily by crime, but by people that don't know how to use guns and that shoot themselves or inadvertently shoot others. Like it happened recently in Georgia. They passed this insane law in Georgia saying, much like in Ohio, that you can walk into a bar with a gun. And they had a guy recently that was walking out of a bar in Georgia. He'd probably been drinking, and he accidentally shot himself in the hand and inadvertently killed a woman who was, like, across the street from the same bullet. So you have a lot of deaths like that. But if you're trained, like they train their children in Switzerland, that's actually have the lowest crime there. So it's an interesting contrast. But we're talking about nuclear
weapons. How are you going to prepare yourself against nuclear fallout by having
a
gun?
That's what I'm going to address right now because the United States has a monopoly of nuclear weapons in outer space. The United States has enough nuclear weapons to blow the entire world up several times over. The United States spends more on the military budget than all the countries combined. The United States has more people in prison than any country in the world, even China, which has over a billion people, literal numbers, not per capita. So you have the criminalization, in particular, of the so-called minorities, and then you have the reaction to the persecution of minorities that we see now in Ferguson. You have a society that's very fearful, as you mentioned earlier, right, the fallout shelters. We have that legacy left over from the Cold War. Now it's the fear of the Arab, of the terrorist, of the Mexican crossing the border, whatever it is. And I'm sure you're very familiar with that fear, right, against Mexicans.
Right.
You're pretty close to the border yourself.
Exactly.
So there's always a fear. There's always a scapegoat and this criminalization and this overreaction, and they're always looking for the scapegoat, the black, the Latino, the Arab, whatever. The Russian. There's a lot of Russophobia going on now since we've been going on with Ukraine. Repeat of the Cold War rhetoric,
What I find very interesting is when we should be focusing on many of these events that are taking place around the world. I mean, it's one crisis after another. We have police departments that are completely out of control in this country where now instead of us focusing on world events, we're focusing on, our kids being murdered in the streets, Instead of us focusing on world events, we're looking at entertainment on television rather than looking at useful information that will help us to be prepared for the future. So this whole society, we're just being bombarded with information, that is going to give us some type of false sense of security. But unfortunately, we aren't prepared for, the next event, such as the 9/11, which, a lot of people question that today. But when you look at world events, we can see what direction that they're taking. And I just want to mention one more thing on fallout shelters. And it says, which I stated earlier, Al, the former Soviet Union and other Eastern Bloc countries often designed their underground massive transit and subway tunnels to serve as bomb and fallout shelters in the event of an attack. So then we're going to talk about some of these other events that are taking place around the world, Al, that we have hot spots everywhere. And when I say, is it time to rethink nuclear fallout shelters, any of these hot spots could create, a hot war. And as I mentioned, mm-hmm. we're not prepared. Now, everyone knows that Ruth Ann is one of my favorite persons on the planet. But she put out something which, I'm glad she put it out there. She said, why would we want fallout shelters? Just curious. And I mm-hmm. think, Al, why do we want war? You know, I would rather be preparing for more peace. I would rather us to be preparing to clean up our environment, to clean our waters. Mm-hmm. Here in California, we're suffering a severe drought. We should be mm-hmm. focusing on how can we take care of our human needs rather than destroying humans. And that's the direction that we see governments moving in, that the direction that governments are moving, how can they destroy, whereas we need to be thinking how can we preserve. And now, so it really brings us to, when we look at all of these topics, and we're going to talk about a few of them, such as the tensions that are growing in Germany, what has taken place in mm-hmm. Libya, what has taken place in the Ukraine, but all mm-hmm. of these are hot spots. What has taken place in Gaza? I mean, these mm-hmm. are hot spots that we see that is creating a lot of unrest and tension in the world, and any of those hot spots could potentially explode into a greater situation that we would be facing on a global level. Would you like, Al, you want to just comment on that very briefly?
Yeah, it's a lot, right?
it's a lot.
Well, let me just say this, that there was an international poll that was conducted not too long ago, and the question was, what country is the greatest threat to world peace? And, of course, the United States was far above anybody else. And, was Pakistan, but that was because of the Indian vote. But the United States is clearly, the biggest threat to world peace. At least we're perceived that way by the world. I mean, we have so many, over 100 military bases throughout the world. And in a lot of these countries, they're supposed to be our allies, and we're spying on them. I mean, a lot of them are doing the same thing, but the United States government is spying on them. I mean, and Snowden revealed that, the NSA, the spying on Germany, for example. There are several U.S. bases still in Germany that have been there for decades. But I think the Germans are finally not going along with the U.S. plan in Ukraine. They're really tired of supporting neo-Nazis in Ukraine because they know their history, right?
Right.
But, the United States, of course, is continuing to pressure Germany and other NATO countries to go along with their plan to continue to support these fascists in Ukraine because they're using them as pawns in their chess game. And it's kind of a repeat of the Cold War, and it's all about Putin, and it's all about protecting the dollar and preventing Putin from joining up with China and India against Western interests. But the Eastern powers could come again, at least economically. And that's something that the U.S. imperialists do not want,
I just want to just very briefly just reintroduce our program and discussion today. Once again, we have Al Suarez. He's joining the program on Left Turn with Stuart Alexander. And we really appreciate Al joining us today. Today our topic is it time to rethink the nuclear fallout shelters? And Al, once again, I want to thank you for joining the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Al, talking about some of these hot spots, Al, in your opinion, do you think that we have a president that is completely out of control?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the best way to describe him. I mean, it's interesting. They send these these black guys into Ferguson to calm the populace, I just saw a video last night. These guys are like mini Obamas over here. Let me give you the perfect example. I think his name's Roy Johnson. He's this police captain who's from Ferguson, who's black. He's one of the three out of 53 policemen from Ferguson that is black. The rest are white, even though 67%, more than 67% of Ferguson residents are black. So they're sending him into the crowd to calm them down. Last night I saw his real face. Okay, they're showing this mm-hmm. guy as a saint. And last night I saw him in a video confronting journalists that were complying with police orders to leave the parking lot, okay? And he's
right.
saying in front of their cameras, arrest these guys, arrest these guys. And they were pleading with them, sir, we're trying to comply with your orders. We're trying to leave. He said, no, arrest these guys. that's the real, you know, guy that you don't see, you know, when they interview him on CNN. You know, this
right.
guy, you know, he it's all in an act to try to calm the local populace.
Uh-huh.
You know, and they're sending in Al Sharpton and they're booing him, and you know, they know these people are sellouts. The people in Ferguson are not stupid. They're intelligent. You know, they're not housewives. They're intelligent. They're with the majority.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
you know, you have Obama, and he's the perfect example of that. He's part of the establishment. He is not descended from slaves. His father was an African. He was raised by his white grandparents. He went to Yale. He went to Harvard. He very much represents the establishment. He's not in touch with the poor blacks in Chicago, where he used to be a representative. He's not in touch with the blacks in Ferguson's and the ghettos and the poor communities within the country. Even here in Tampa, my African-American brothers and sisters that I went to protest recently in solidarity with Ferguson expressed their frustration with Obama and what he's doing. And I think it's a good thing that now even in the mainstream media, journalists are expressing their indignation at how they're being treated and being attacked in Ferguson, just as journalists have been attacked in Gaza. Now it's happening here at home.
Right. You know, I often read – I might mention much of the material that I was reading on the history of fallout shelters. I was taken right from Wikipedia. But looking at here with the U.S. expanding this war in Iraq, we see here in the World Socialist website, and you know I'm a frequent reader of their materials, it says a Pentagon statement yesterday declared that U.S. forces were now operating to protect critical infrastructure as well as support Iraqi security forces and Kurdish defense forces who are working together to combat ISIS fighters. Obama is expanding the U.S. military intervention in Iraq without even the formality of a hearing on Capitol Hill, let alone congressional authorization. He simply informed Congress that he had authorized the latest airstrikes. Now, when I ask you, is this president completely out of control? Al, he doesn't even consult with Congress anymore.
Well, let me tell you this. When he's bombing ISIS,
what's going on?
Well, look. When he's bombing ISIS, this is very interesting. When he's bombing ISIS,
yeah, talk to us.
I've never seen a single shred of evidence that when he bombed ISIS, he's killed any civilians.
Right.
And ISIS surrounds themselves with civilians. Okay.
Right.
So if the United States has the capability to strike military targets, legitimate military targets, and to attack ISIS fighters without wounding or killing any civilians, which I have seen no evidence that they've done that yet. Okay,
right.
If they have the capability to do that, why is it in other occasions when they bomb Fallujah with chemical weapons that they impact entire populaces of civilians? They had the capabilities all along just to strike military, but they could care less because it's about terrorizing the population into submission. And the United States created ISIS, practically created ISIS. They send their wounded soldiers to the hospitals in Tel Aviv.
We created ISIS.
And now they're going against ISIS.
We created Al-Qaeda. We installed Maliki.
They're an offshoot of Al-Qaeda as well, ISIS.
Yeah.
Because they were using them against Assad. The United States is serious about
tell us a little
ISIS.
Bit about what.
They should support
PKK. Where did the Taliban come from? Where did the Taliban come from? Where did the
Taliban
come
from? Saudi Arabia, most of them. The Al Qaeda.
No, the Taliban was actually to fight the Russians. They were trained by the CIA.
They were Afghan exiles in Pakistan, and they were sent back into Afghanistan to fight the Russians with U.S. backing, and they sent in Al-Qaeda at the time. Al-Qaeda in Arabic means the base, so they sent in these internationalists, these fake internationalists from their bases in Saudi Arabia along with bin Laden. And yes, they went in there and they fought the Russians. They sent the Mujahideen, the so-called holy fighters, into China.
Right.
And the Soviets came to the assistance of a socialist government in Afghanistan. And instead, they supported these reactionary, you know, Islamists, if you like to call them that, who took over in Afghanistan. So the United States has created a lot of the problems that it's trying to clean up now. Yeah.
Al, I could see this coming with Nouri al-Maliki. I could see what was coming down the pipe with him. I just knew it was a matter of time. I mean,
yep.
But I mean, could you explain to our listeners, I mean, because I see the U.S. all over this. I see the U.S. all over this from 2003 until to present. I think the plan was actually what we see happening today, because people need to understand that we are already committing more troops into Iraq. We're already committing more troops. We're committing air power over Iraq. These are things mm-hmm. that we don't see on the news every day, and when we see it on the news, they try to paint it that here are these bad people which have been surrounded and supported by many of our congressional leaders, such as John McCain. You know, he's a favorite of theirs. But, Al, we're already involved in war. I should say involved. It's a continuation of the war that started in 2003. To the latest mm-hmm. count, how many people had we lost over there in that war?
In Iraq, I believe, 5,000.
Close to, now, over 5,500?
Well, I guess you're counting also Afghanistan, but I think it was about 5,000
in Iraq.
Oh,
that's Afghanistan and Iraq.
Right. Yeah, I mean, at the protest recently, they said that the U.S. police have killed more black people in the time, was 10 years that the United States was in Iraq, where over 5,000 were killed. There was even more that were killed by police officers in the United States. So it's really a war, and it's a slow motion genocide on the people that was being done here. Then a lot of those same black and brown skin people are in an economic draft, and they find no other choice but for legal economic means to join up with the military, and they're sent to the front lines. You know, and my friend told me the other day, he's like, Obama said no boots on the ground. So these so-called trainers that he's sending out, what's he going to send them in, sandals?
Right.
Because, the trainers, I mean, come on. The trainers are soldiers, too. You know, and they're doing more than just guarding buildings, I tell you that. And they got mercenaries in there. You know, they have the U.S. bases still over there. So
well, they never
break,
took
you know?
The mercenaries out. They were always there.
They sent them to Ukraine, too. You know, they sent them to Ukraine, and now they have a humanitarian convoy in eastern Ukraine that the government in Kiev finally, under pressure, let come in from Russia. But I wouldn't be surprised if they start to attack that convoy, and then Putin will have to send in troops.
Well, you know, I see a lot of this stuff that takes place out throughout the world, and supposedly it's to protect American interests. You know, it's surprising anywhere there's oil, anywhere there's any natural resources, is always American interests. In other words, their interest is if they have any resources, including human resources, that's American interest. In other words, Americans take interest there. But now, you know, we destroyed the regime of Saddam Hussein and had him killed. And now, you know, here we have another puppet government but we have new leadership that will be coming in that the U.S. is trying to prop up. But, Al, this is another hot spot, and Americans need to wake up. Not only are mm-hmm. we talking about sending more of our young people to war and more conflicts, but it's creating more enemies for the U.S. throughout the world. People, you know, what did you say a few minutes ago when the survey was done? People, the countries that people disrespect or hate the most, who was it, the U.S., you said?
Well, they consider the United States the biggest threat to world
peace. The biggest threat. Right.
Something
so when
you're
going and invading countries, when you're going and establishing new regimes or whatever, Al, that's a threat.
Right.
Let me tell you this.
You were mentioning Saddam Hussein earlier.
Right.
There's something really ironic about Saddam Hussein is he was from Tikrit, okay?
Uh-huh.
And Salah Adin, who was the liberator of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, who liberated Jerusalem for the Arabs and kicked the Crusaders out. Salah Adin was a Kurd from Tikrit. And Hussein was responsible for the massacre of the Kurds. Because it's really sad that a lot of the Arabs do not know their own history, and they divide themselves from Kurd, from Sunni, from Shia. And really, if they were all united, then the West or an imperialist wouldn't keep coming into their country and robbing their resources.
Al, we're going to talk just a little bit about Libya because, again, another hot spot. But, you know, what I was mentioning earlier, Al, you have countries, empires, whether you go back to the Greeks, if you go back to the Romans, you go back to the Carthaginians, whatever empire, the French, when you look at the British, empires, what they do, Al, is over a period of time, they expand and they grow. And it's all about conquest and trying to maintain territories. And we see ourselves doing the same thing. Let's look at the Romans. The Romans did the same thing. They were expanding. They were expanding into Africa. They were expanding as far as into northern Europe. A lot of people don't know that.
But look at Carthage. Carthage is the perfect example, and what Rome did to Carthage is just despicable. I mean, Hannibal from the Pyrenees, from modern-day Spain, was able to bring Rome almost down to their knees.
To their knees.
Of course, is
and that was during the early years of the Roman Empire.
And Gaddafi's son, one of Gaddafi's sons, is named Hannibal after him. So Gaddafi was very aware of this history, and I always said it was very ironic that Hillary Clinton and the Western powers were meeting Rome discussing how to invade Libya, and part of Libya was also Carthage, Tunisia, Libya, and they were going and repeating history what Rome did, and they decimated that beautiful country. So history does repeat itself.
And it's repeating itself
ultimately
now.
Hannibal
we're doing the same thing. I mean, Al, if you look at it, we're – if you look at military installations, we're in over 780 spots around the world. 780 spots. I mean, that's a vast empire. People need to understand what that word imperialism means, because that's where we're at. But
I was in a meeting. Go ahead.
Yeah, go on. What was that?
About imperialism. It's related to imperialism. The other day I was in – you ever heard of Toastmasters? They give speeches, public speaking, things like that. Yeah, I've attended a couple of their meetings before. I'm not a member or anything, and a friend of mine invited me to one of these meetings, and then the topic was quixotic, you know, like Don Quixote, dreamers, idealistic. And one of the people that invited me there is Venezuelan, and she had met Chavez before. And she's like, oh, the perfect example of quixotic, Chavez, and, you know, he was very dreamy about imperialism. And then I emailed her later because it wouldn't be very good etiquette to she invited me, you know, to you know, counter what she was saying. But I emailed her later. I mean, she used to support Chavez, and I emailed her later, and I'm like, it's not a dream. It's a reality. You don't know what's going on in Latin America. You know, almost every single South American government, including some Central American governments, is anti-imperialist today.
Right,
so
exactly.
So it's no longer a dream. It's real. And that's very inspiring. As a matter of fact, you had more Latin American countries come out and condemn the slaughter in Gaza than Arab countries.
Right.
Where are the Arab countries?
Yeah, exactly.
Where is the Arab League? Because they don't represent the people. They don't represent the Arab street. These are sheiks. These are dictators. You know, Sisi is completely complicit in the blockade of Gaza. Right now, Abbas is meeting with Sisi, pleading with him to open the borders because Abbas reconciled with Hamas already. They have a national unity government. And that's probably part of the reason the timing of the Israeli slaughter in Gaza, to prevent that unity that they've been trying to keep them divided for a long time. I mean, Julius Caesar coined the phrase divide and conquer, and that's a reality today. They're Machiavellian and behind closed doors making these meetings and planning their way to divide and conquer and rob these people that have a rich history. And Gaza was under siege by Alexander the Great. And Gaza's gone through a lot. You know, the Philistines, the people from that area historically have been occupied, have been persecuted. It's time for them to have their own country. It's time for them to be able to live with dignity, and it's time to lift the siege and the blockade and for them to have a port and an access to the Mediterranean and access to the world.
Well, and we had that discussion last weekend, and I believe that the Israelis, I believe they are the invaders. They're the ones that are occupying. And that's what we see took place here in this country with the Native American Indians here. The same thing took place. Let's take a look at Libya for a second, Al. Another hot spot. And Al, you know, what I see taking place is the U.S. is trying to secure their foothold. I mean, it's very strategic what they're doing. Is they're trying to secure their foothold on the borders of Russia, right on the borders. You know, firstly, mm-hmm. we're talking about this missile defense shield to protect them against Iran. Boy, I mean, everyone could see through that. Why do you want to put missiles on the borders of Russia? But now we're going back in to secure these areas such as Iraq and Libya and installing new governments and new regimes and like that. But, Al, I mean, everything is pointing to, you know, where the U.S. is trying to solidify their positions for, you know, potentially something even greater. And you know, I don't want to seem like the complete pessimist as far as in world events, but, you know, Al, I call a spade, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It is what it is.
Well, they say that all the real leaders in Africa and in the Middle East are in jail right now. If you release Marwan Barghouti, you know, and Mandela compared himself to Marwan Barghouti. If you release Marwan Barghouti, who his cellmate is a Hamas member, by the way, even though he's part of Fatah, they're brothers.
Right.
If you release somebody like Marwan Barghouti and let him get in elections again, I mean, Abbas, up until now, has had no, you know, courageousness whatsoever. Now, finally, he's starting to reconcile with Hamas because they're seeing that negotiating with Israel is, you know, there's no, you know, possibility.
It's futile.
And another example is Saif al-Islam, who's the very charismatic and a very popular son of the late Muammar Gaddafi, who's being held in a prison in Western Libya right now. If he was released and there was elections, I mean, even in Egypt, Mubarak had a political party that ran an election. Sisi is part of Mubarak's legacy, okay? So if
right.
in Egypt, the former ruler who was deposed allowed to have a political party associated with him, why can't there be a political party in Libya that's associated with the Gaddafi tribe where Saif al-Islam could run? Because they know he would win. So they're not
right.
going to let that happen. Not under the current conditions, but that government is crumbling. I think that if Saif al-Islam was released, that he could also be a leader there.
You know, when I look at, I mean, we've had this thing going on forever in regards to Benghazi, which, you know, that was something that I believe that, you know, we were negligent, deliberately negligent, and, of course, that has had broad ramifications. But when I look at Libya, again, what I see took place with NATO and the U.S., that was completely illegal. I mean, would you agree?
By the way, Sisi only 7.5% of Egyptians voted the elections that brought Sisi to power, by the way. So I'm not trying to say in any way that Sisi is popular, you know.
Uh-huh. But in regards to what I was saying about NATO and what took place when the overthrow of the Libyan government.
Yeah, that was the first time they intervened in Africa. NATO's out of control.
Right. That's why I was curious if you were on the same page with me here. NATO's out of control, whether it's in Africa or whether it's in Europe, wherever NATO is, wherever they are, NATO is out of control. But since we overthrew the Gaddafi government, do you realize, Al, there has been a change of six leaders in that country within that short period of time? Six?
Yeah, and during the Cold War, NATO was not allowed to pass East Berlin. And now they're all over the place. They're at the doors of Russia. You know, I used to call NATO Nazis Addicted to Occupation. That was one of the abbreviations right there. Because they can't help but try to occupy and invade countries. That's what they do. And now they're literally supporting and backing Nazis, neo-Nazis, openly fascist groups in Ukraine that are associated with a new government.
Well,
and large
NATO,
swaths
what
of Ukraine did not take part in the elections or under attack.
Uh-huh.
You know, they had the Molotov cocktails thrown at the protesters, peace protesters in Odessa, in southern Ukraine. These were ethnic Russians. This is in eastern Ukraine. They didn't take part in the elections either. So I don't know the exact percentage, but Poroshenko, he wasn't elected by a consensus either.
Oh, no. No, basically, he was installed. And I might mention he was actually trained by this government, you know, and prepared to be in the position that he's in.
Absolutely.
What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, the guy's a billionaire. You know, that says it all. I mean, he's an opportunist. When the Soviet Union fell, he took full advantage of the situation. He was able to enrich himself. And he's a very shady guy. He played different sides, you know. Even the former president of Ukraine, he was part of his government as well. I mean, the guy's from Odessa, but he's not a Russian by any means. He's Ukrainian, you know. But he's, you know, he I mean, he's not a fascist. He's a capitalist. But he's, you know, using fascists to acquire what he wants. You know, he uses the right sector militia, you know, to go after dissenters and to try to invade eastern Ukraine, you know. So he's, you know, basically, it's not him being bullied by fascists and he's some, you know, oh, poor capitalist. No, he's very much going along and cooperating with the fascists that are controlling large sections of the military in western Ukraine.
You know, much of what people have to consider when they look at Libya and they look at these countries, especially in the Middle East, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, many of the resources, you have to realize that there's close to $700 billion barrels of oil. That's a huge sum of oil. Not to mention in Russia, I believe, has the second largest deposits of oil in the world. Am I correct on that, Al?
Yeah, I mean, the Middle East,
so when
Saudi Arabia and Iran and
when you consider Russia
Venezuela
and those areas,
reserves,
you're talking,
but Russia
you're talking
is
about,
a huge country.
You're talking about a trillion barrels of fuel. I mean,
the oil in Venezuela, for example, is not refined, right? So there's different types of oils, but I know that Russia is a major oil supplier. It is, and it's a very large nation. I mean,
and also
Siberia,
to Europe.
Just Siberia, the size of Siberia is like, what, all of Western Europe? And that's just one part of Russia. Yeah.
So, you know, when we think about what has taken place, as I mentioned, ever since the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi, there has been nothing but turmoil and chaos. And for us to go in there and say, you know, to establish democracy, whenever the U.S. talk about establishing democracy, Al, it's nothing but a joke. I mean,
right.
We
Saeed,
don't have no
Saeed
concept.
Law, for example,
we have no
mother.
Concept what a democracy is. Not
yes,
when it comes to the leadership
and
in this country.
Something I forgot to mention earlier, Saeed Islam's mother is from eastern Ukraine. So, you know, the people that are saying, oh, Benghazi, and I don't think she's from a town far from Benghazi. So, you know, he's got both sides of Libya there. There was a time when both sides of Libya was united. But, you know, there were separatist groups in Benghazi, and the CIA took full advantage of it and brought back these guys to separate from the rest of Ukraine. If it wasn't for the NATO bombings of cities, then the militias in eastern Ukraine wouldn't have a chance to go even near Tripoli because there was still a huge portion of the populace that were supporting Gaddafi. Millions were going out in the streets supporting him while NATO were bombing cities. And
now,
why is
that?
Because of the conditions in Libya. They had the best conditions out of the entire continent of Africa. They had vast oil wealth and people were taken care of. Gaddafi considered himself a socialist, and he was taking care of his people. He was trying to unite Africa, unite the Arabs.
Yeah, and Al, I don't want people to get the impression that I'm a Putin supporter, which I'm not, you know.
Yeah,
but,
Putin's a different case, yeah.
Yeah, I'm for peace. I'm not for war. I think that, you know, I prefer to live in a world where we take care of the needs, human needs, and forget about the greed for the very few that are on this planet. When you consider, you know, some of the richest people in the world, I mean, we think about people like Bill Gates. Those are the people that we see. Al, when we think about the richest people on the planet, these people are worth trillions of dollars. Al, did you hear what I said? The richest people, they don't even talk about them. When they talk about the richest people in the world, they throw out a few names and say, this person's worth $30 billion. This person's worth, you know, $50 billion, $60 billion. But, Al, the people that are really in control, I mean the real oligarchs, we're talking about people that control trillions of dollars. These are the best.
As long as there's no justice, economic, social, political justice, there cannot be peace in the world. There cannot be humanity in the world when there's abject poverty, when the rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poor, when exploitation continues, when imperialism continues. There should be a world with no empires. There should be a world with no division and borders. And these things are possible because even in the EU, they had their borders open. I could have traveled from Spain to France and not shown any identification. A lot of people don't know that here in America, that in the EU there are borders.
Yeah, see, I love that.
I don't like the
thought that we have a southern border where, you know, that Bush spent $40 billion to build that perimeter system there. I don't like that thought. I prefer, I mean, the Canadian borders, I mean, they're surveillance.
I went to Canada. I went to French Canada as a kid without a passport.
Did you see any walls?
Now you need a passport. To go to Puerto Rico,
did you see
you
any
don't,
walls?
Right, the colony of Puerto Rico, you don't. But to Canada, you have to have a passport now. It's ridiculous.
But do you see any? Do you see any? Do you see
Mexico
any fortifications?
The Israelis helping to build.
But there's no fortifications, is what I'm saying. So you know, when you know, I want people to understand. I'm no supporter of Putin. But the thing is, when I see what we're doing here, we're creating a world where eventually we're heading. You know, as I was reading this article by Stephen Lindman, it says terrorizing southeastern Ukrainians, heading toward east-west confrontation, and that's what it's all about.
Yep.
Al, it's all about world domination. It's not about taking care of the needs of working people. It's not about creating peace in the world. It's all about world domination. The interests of working people, the interests of working people are so different from the interests of the super elite in the world.
But if Kosovo, for example, voted to join Albania, right? Be part of Greater Albania, because most of the Kosovars are Albanian or Albanian descent.
Right.
If that happened, the West would have fully backed that. But Crimea, which are predominantly Russian, that voted to rejoin Russia, no, they're not going to accept that, and they're going to make restrictions and punish Putin because of what the Crimeans decided. As a matter of fact, the eastern Ukrainians have already had a similar vote saying they wanted to rejoin Russia, and Putin's refused because he said no, that they maybe should be part of Ukraine, and they should try to settle differences with the government there. So Putin's being reasonable there.
Right.
And again, I'm not saying that as a pro-Putin position. That's just reality. He's been very reasonable up till now. But the West is defaming him because they love to demonize people that could be their potential enemies, regardless if they're Arab, Russian, or whoever.
Well, we can see that, you know, that in Russia that they're taking certain positions of conciliation where they're trying to work with these criminal elements, these criminal governments, the criminal leadership that's there. But we can see that it's all about push. I mean, even this thing, at first they were pushing that about the Malaysian airline and the downing of that.
The Malaysians
and now
know that it was downed by Western Ukrainians. That's already officially come out. That's why Obama's not talking about it anymore.
That's why they're not talking
about
it.
The gas that killed those civilians in Syria anymore, because then it came out that it was the rebels. So the United States, you know, love to say that we know this is true, and then when the truth comes out, silence.
Right. What was happening is the lie was being exposed. And once the lie was being exposed, and we don't want to talk about that, you know?
Right. It was the Western Ukrainians that shot it down. The Eastern Ukrainians didn't have those weapons. It was physically impossible that they shot the plane down.
Right. So, I mean, but, you know, just focusing on what's taking place there in the Ukraine, I might mention, Al, so our listeners understand, you know, how vicious the acts that are taking place there in Ukraine against civilians, you know, Al, is every bit on the same level of what is going on with Gaza and the way that Israel is attacking citizens, civilians there. I mean, they are massacring people, civilians there on the ground. You know, trying to force the Russian hand to be able to do something ridiculous, and give them a reason to be able to go into an armed conflict.
And I give you two numbers right now that are facts that are what's going on in Ukraine. So far, since the new government was installed, there's been 700,000 Ukrainians that have fled to Russia, including some members of the Ukrainian army, and some of those members of the Ukrainian army joined up with self-defense forces in eastern Ukraine. So this is not simply a geographical issue. A lot of them are
shoring up that government right now.
And not only that,
the U.S. is shoring up that government. On the verge of collapse.
Yeah, and not only that, but I heard up to 10,000 people have been killed in eastern Ukraine so far. So larger numbers than Gaza. Yes, it's a larger area, but still, you have massacres, people burned alive. And all the evidence shows that they were killed by fascists. And then in the New York Times, they said that they threw Molotov cocktails on themselves. I mean, this is just pure propaganda.
What is the U.S. saying about all of this?
The what?
What is the U.S. saying about all this chaos that has taken place there in Ukraine?
They're saying
that they're
bringing it on themselves, that the Eastern Ukrainians are responsible for everything, that they brought down the plane, that they're terrorists. And it's funny, right? Because they used to just call terrorists Muslim people.
Right.
But now Orthodox Christian people and Jewish people in Eastern Ukraine are called terrorists. You think Israel would be interested in that? They could care less about protecting Jews. They want to protect their interests because Jews are going after, have been persecuted. They're going after them, these anti-Semites, these fascist groups in Western Ukraine. That's going on as well. Rabbis are telling Jews to evacuate cities that are being taken over by the new government. This is the facts on the ground. You don't hear about that on the CNN.
Right. Well, one of the reasons why they probably not call them terrorists is when they used to call them Muslims in other parts of the world. I mean, people don't realize a lot of people that live in that part of the around Ukraine and Russia, many of those people are Muslims. But the thing is, they're not people of color.
Well, yeah, there's some Tatar Muslims in Crimea, for example, and a lot of
they don't look like they're black.
They're afraid of the fascists, who are the real terrorists in this situation.
Right. So, you know, it's something how race always plays a part in all these events. Al, you know, when I look at, you know, and I want to include this because many of these events can grow into something much broader. We have Gaza, and we have the world. The world is really divided behind this situation in Gaza.
The problem is
that even in my own family. Even in my own family.
Well, Stuart, the problem is that even Palestinian Americans that I know personally live in this community, okay? And, and Ukrainians, Jewish Ukrainians from Eastern Ukraine that I'm speaking to that I know that live in this community, okay? The problem is a lot of these immigrants come here and they become part of the American bubble. And a lot of them are aware they're part of the American bubble. They love to be part of the American bubble. That's what the American dream is now. It's, you know, and in a way, it's quixotic as well. I mean, the American dream now is remaining in a bubble and not being aware of what's going on in the world, even when it's your hometown. Because
now
I'm American. Now
I
have to assimilate. Now I can't speak my native language. And that's so unfortunate, the lack of multiculturalism and internationalism within our country. You have nationalism and chauvinism that is dominating the situation in this country, and that needs to be countered. There needs to be a counterculture.
And Alan, it's very interesting that you mentioned that because I see a lot of people that are of Mexican descent. And they have that same attitude. They feel like they're part of the American dream. And they don't consider themselves, they don't look at themselves as Mexicans. They say, you know, I understand they're Americans. People that are living in Mexico are Americans. People living in South America are Americans. But they feel like now, you know, I'm part of this American dream. But, you know, I look at this as one world. You know, we all come from one community.
They're accepting breadcrumbs. They're accepting breadcrumbs. They deserve the whole loaf. That's what, you know, these collective bargaining, all these rights of the workers, migrant workers, they're not getting these rights, and they're accepting breadcrumbs, and that's all, because they have a low self-esteem because they've been brainwashed and they've accepted that bubble, and that bubble needs to be broken. And the system cannot just be fixed. It cannot just have reform. There has to be transformative revolutionary change. That's the only way.
Now,
when
I
see that he was serious about that as well, you know.
I have one more minute, and I definitely want to give you the last word, but I just want to ask you, based on our discussion today and all that has taken place, the chaos that's taken place all over the world, is it time to rethink nuclear fallout shelters? Do you have the last word?
That's just a fear tactic. I mean, it's symbolic. I mean, if there's a nuclear explosion, there's not going to be anywhere to hide. So that's all just, you know, useless fear tactics, and I don't think we should focus on that.
Okay. Well, I think we need to focus on peace and what we see taking place around the world with the U.S. intervention in many of the world affairs. We need to keep focus on the U.S. and make certain we take care of what needs to be done here at home. But, Al, once again, I'd like to thank you for joining the program. How can our listeners reach you?
I'm on your page and Ruthann's page, Al Suarez, Suarez.
Well, Al, once again, I thank you for joining the program. I look forward to having you to join us in the future. And, again, I'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in to Left Turn with Stuart Alexander. We'll see you next week. Thanks again, Al. Thank you, Ruthann. Have a good night, everyone.
Thanks, guys. Good night.
You're listening to Air Marte Fio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Dialogue. I'm Ruthanna Martefio, and tonight Karen Patrick is going to talk about the power of, the power of human attention. Hello, Karen.
Hello. I need to let people know that I live in Texarkana, Texas. It's a little bit the Tornado Alley type weather, and about a half hour before this call, we suddenly had a storm front move in. I looked on the radar, it's north of us, and we're getting the tippy bottom of it. So hopefully I'll stay on the air and nothing, too bad will happen. But it was like, oh, I'm doing the show, and all of a sudden here comes the storm. Go figure.
Yeah, don't put yourself in any kind of danger with your electronics.
I'm 5 feet away from my closet I plan to dive in. But I believe all we're going to get is just we're getting thunder, little bit of wind, and I looked at the front. It's just going to pass by us, I think. But, fun with weather, right? You live in this, it's part of the country.
Well, I think anywhere you live now with climate change, it's not behaving the way it usually does anyway. So we all have that to think about.
Yes, I know. Well, anyway, hopefully I'm with you, and I'm super excited to talk about this. What I'm doing is I'm going to be reading off my slideshow I produced. I'm going to be talking to the Edgar Casey ARE group that's here in Texarkana on Wednesday, and I have this was my preparation for that group, and I thought it'd be a very wonderful first, dress rehearsal, first of all, to talk to everyone, but, your show's wonderful, so it's not a dress rehearsal at all. It's really great people that are listening to us, and I'm super excited to share.
I had some notes, and now it seems like I'm frozen up here, and I can't,
Well, I'll move. Start. How's
get
that?
To them.
How if I just
but,
start in?
I wanted to say that this is something that, it actually, human attention, this is on different levels, and people from the spiritual side have known this forever, and I think that other people now are catching up.
Absolutely. It is an esoteric kind of concept. However, the powers that be that run the planet do know esoteric concepts, and they utilize this particular one very well to keep us all paying attention to what they're doing, and that's an important concept. But also, we're in that transition from the Newtonian, Sir Isaac Newton, and the Einstein, and all those guys that are very taken up with particle physics, which has kind of dominated our science to this point. We now have quantum physics, which is beginning to tell us the energy behind the scenes, so to speak, of our reality construct. And I'm going to be sharing some different places where this information is beginning to kind of marry esoteric concepts with scientific concepts that are controversial, and I am not a certified scientist. I'm just a very curious student who I do have a computer science credits and whatnot, but I just wanted to know all of this, and I researched, and I'm always good at asking pretty good questions, and I met some people that I learned from, and I'm going to be sharing about that in this presentation on Wednesday, but with you guys also. So I can dive right in if you like.
Sure. Actually, I think I'm finding it, so I'll be able to. Okay. Yes, just begin.
Okay, good. Okay, so I'm going to start this presentation with kind of a joke. a funny story. Years ago, I was house-sitting for a lady, and she had teenage kids that had pets, and they had a dog, and they had a cat, and they had about a 6-foot iguana, which kind of freaked me out. But it was okay. They told me how to feed the iguana. It was okay. But after I got through my weekend and was a little creeped out by the iguana, I made up a joke, and it goes like this. A dog and a cat and an iguana walk into a bar. Okay? And the bartender says, I know, it's not a good joke, but it's illustrative, but I'm not done yet, so hopefully you'll like the punchline. A dog and a cat and an iguana walk into a bar, and the bartender turns and sees them coming in, and he points to them, and he says, "We don't serve your kind here. You have to leave." So the dog is very sad, and he droops his tail, and he droops his head, and he skulks out of the bar, you know, king dog. And then the cat is very insulted, and it puts its nose up in the air and its tail up in the air, and it walks out of the bar. And the iguana doesn't do anything except start staring at the bartender and staring and staring. It doesn't blink. It's still staring. And the bartender walks out of the bar. And that's the joke. And it's fun, a joke, because it illustrates very well the power of attention. And this is true for humans, and it's true for the animal kingdom as well, the power of a fixed gaze, the power of focused visualization, because it's actually an ecologic necessity. It's an evolutionary necessity that if you're a deer and a cougar starts to stare at you, it's really helpful if you pick up on that you're being stared at by someone who looks at you as a meal ticket, and you skedaddle out of there. So now I've read, now humans experience this. You can be stared at, and you can feel that stare. One of the more traditional scientific explanations for that I read about was a gentleman who said, well, what happens is you'll see it out of the corner of your eye, or you'll glance up, and then you won't register right away, but you actually saw it. You just didn't know you saw it, and that's why you feel the stare.
That doesn't explain when somebody is totally behind you and you feel them staring at you.
Unless you have eyes in the back of your head. Exactly. Yes. And I think you're right. I've did this in a class one time where we were talking about attention energy in relation to job interviews and how you make that energetic connection with someone. And we did that. We actually had that where we picked out partners, and then we kept walking closer and closer to the person until the person felt that stare, right? And then would say, okay, stop, you know. And I'm pretty psychic, so I don't think they take too many steps in my case, because I really pick up on that. So I believe in that. I believe there's an energy there that is, and that's what they were trying to get us to understand, is the energy is part of human interaction, and it's important to pay attention to in a job interview. But anyway, that's where I first kind of started exploring that topic, and I just became very interested in that. So over the years, I've been reading up on it. And I want to start my talk with a gentleman named David Boehm, B-O-H-M. David Boehm was an American theoretical physicist who contributed to quantum theory and philosophy of the mind and neuropsychology, and did TV interviews and whatnot. And he was the teacher of my teacher. So I have a teacher here that we'll tell you about later, and this was the teacher of my teacher. And one of the things David Boehm participated in, along with other physicists as well, is the double slit experiment. And this was where they took a photon gun and they aimed photons at these two slits in a, I don't know what it was made of, it was some kind of card. And the idea was to say, if it's a photon, it's going to come out one side. If the energy is a wave, it's going to come out in a wave pattern. And this has been repeated many times. But basically it was very interesting because they found that when someone was observing this or even setting up this experiment and they believed that the underlying energy was a particle, they would get one result. And if they believed that the underlying energy was a wave, they'd get another result. And so they kind of came up with the idea that what is going on in the subquantum level, and believe me, I'm not a physicist, so, you know, this is just my understanding, but basically that our underlying energetic construct is a wave and a particle, so they called it a wavicle, actually. So this is still going on, this debate is still going on about is it a wave, is it a particle, is it a... So we're continuing to gather information. So I'm going to share some of the information that I found on it. And one of David Bohm's terms that he came up with was there was an implicate order. In other words, no matter what we see or what our opinion is or whatever's going on, that there was an implicate order to nature where everything was connected, actually. So he really reached back into the esoteric philosophy of it's all one thing, right? And anything that we see as sort of, as we see as separate objects is actually just an illusion that it's separate. But anyway, I want to read a quote because I really like it. The actual order, the implicate order itself, has been recorded in the complex movement of electromagnetic fields in the form of light waves. Such movement of light waves is present everywhere and in principle enfolds the entire universe of space and time in each region. This enfoldment and unfoldment, and that's an important term, enfoldment and unfoldment, takes place not only in the movement of the electromagnetic field but also in that of other fields. These fields obey quantum mechanical laws implying the properties of discontinuity and non-locality. The total of the movement of enfoldment and unfoldment may go immensely beyond what has revealed itself in our observations. We call this totality by the name of holo movement, H-O-L-O movement, and we talked about holons last time. This would be akin to a hologram. So if you see a character moving through a Pixar movie, like maybe Shrek or something, and he's moving through the forest, he is a hologram moving through a hollow environment. And in fact, there's quite a bit of discussion nowadays that we live in a quantum hologram, meaning that what we think is solid objects, they're solid to us because we're made of the same stuff, but we're actually moving in a hologram environment. And just to kind of also illustrate it, people that are fans of Star Trek know that they have a place for, they're on the ship and they want to take a break, they can go to the hollow deck, and it's basically like a movie theater, but you're inside the movie. So you get to move around and go back in time and, you know, fight with monsters and play games and visit a historical period of time, you know, in this holodeck where basically the idea is you're real and everything else is just a hologram. And when you turn it off, of course, you're still there, but everything disappears. Well, if we ourselves are in a hologram, it's like a hologram within a hologram, right? So that's an interesting thing to contemplate, and it's definitely in the discussion these days about what exactly our reality is. So that's the big debate. Are we particles of matter or patterns of energy or both? And if you were able to see my slides, you'd notice that I would have a picture of the flower of life symbol that comes from esoteric times, and that's believed to be a two-dimensional representation of the underlying grid, okay, like you'd have a hologram grid where it has the points of where things are in the space, is actually the flower of life is a representation of the interlocking grid that this quantum universe, holographic universe is built on, which is really fascinating because it means our ancient ancestors knew this, and they're practically screaming it out from all of the depictions in temples and in places of temples and burial tombs in Egypt and, you know, just all kinds of places where these symbols of this underlying energetic keeps popping up. And that's because they're trying to tell us something. They're trying to give us the idea of what our true scientific energetic base is from. We're just the learners, I guess. But anyway, that's the idea. And then we'll be going into in this talk the work of Dan Winter, D-A-N, Winter like the season. I'm a real big fan. He wasn't my teacher, but I'm a huge fan of Dan Winter's work. He's kind of controversial. Pretty much everyone I'm interested in is controversial. I think I'm controversial, but anyway. His work is with, okay, this enfoldment and unfoldment idea. So what that means is enfoldment is things flowing in, energy flowing in, okay, enfolded. Like you fold up something, you're enfolding it, right? Unfoldment is energy going out. So, like, right now I'm not nervous about being on the radio, but I'm in a warm room. So I'm emitting heat. So that's energy that's emitting from me, okay? And earlier today I had a really great sandwich with lots of tomatoes on it. Well, that was my food. That was my enfoldment. That was the energy I put into my body. But we're not completely dependent on food for our energy. We also receive energy from the sun. Well, how do we do that? Well, that comes into each and every one of our cells in our body have the ability to receive other kinds of energies to energize us, and that's how energetic healing works. When we receive energy from, very positive types of energy patterns, when we meditate and the things that we do that is, really positive for us that way, or we just relax, just be at peace and become centered and be around good people, and we start to feel really good. That's because we've kicked in that enfoldment process where we're bringing energy in. Literally every one of our cells is being energized by that good, positive energy. That's why it feels good. So that's that process. We have part, and some people will know about the Merkaba, when it's spinning, it's enfolding and unfolding energy patterns, right? So that's kind of the, I just had a big bolt of lightning next to me, so that's really fun.
Well, before
so that
you go,
will be the next,
I had a question,
that's
Karen.
The slide that I had. Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to ask, because what we call the ancients, although we're just talking maybe a few thousand years ago, they had this knowledge. So what, why doesn't everybody have it now? Or was that there again, just the high priests and things that knew this? What do you think?
That's a great question. That's a really mysterious story right by itself. And
okay.
I kind of answer that in the next section, so you're very prescient. But yes, exactly.
Okay.
Because we operate for quite a long time now in the world system, I guess, world governance and big religions. We operate on a different information set. We're not given all the information. It
right.
is kept, in a sense, by the high priest. And they use it. The top echelons of the world government use this energy. So that's what I was going to speak about next. Okay, so going back to the idea of your human attention, as I was studying all of this, I came up with a term that made sense to me, and I was able to use that to figure out more, is it's an attention engine. It's an attention engine. It's like if you pointed a laser beam at a piece of rock, it would start heating up the rock. There's something going on with our attention, our human-focused attention, that's causing rotation and heat, and it's causing an effect, okay? And that's important to realize how important that is, to know that your attention is very powerful, not just your intention. A lot of people have been learning about the law of attraction and your intention, but your literal focus of your eyeballs and your mind is also very important. So we know that, because if we watch a lot of depressing things, we'll get depressed, in movies or whatever, and if we watch some fun things, we do know somewhat of, we have to be careful what we look at or watch or pay attention to, because it will affect us emotionally. But it also affects the thing we're looking at, and that was what I was going to talk about next, was this attention engine actually feeds energy to the thing that we're looking at, and that's why when these scientists would be looking at an experiment, they could sort of change it. And there's been a lot of studies of how things can be changed with the focus of the mind. And this is a huge area of human interest. It actually is the baseline of prayer. So you have to be looking at with your eyes. This is really more like with your eyes connects to our mind, but it's really looking with your mind. It's what your mind is focused on, your third eye maybe, And so we know this is how prayer works. When you're thinking of someone and you want to send them good energy, or pray for them, you're feeding them from your attention engine. You're giving them energy from that part of you that is caring and loving and hopes the best for that person. And so that's it, is this attention, this energy of energy of the mind, so to speak, is causing an effect. And what I found out in my studies is that the part that makes it energized in an enfoldment kind of way, and this is what Dan Winter talks about, is it uses centripetal motion. So what that means is there's this enfoldment and unfoldment energy. We kind of know the word, a lot of people know what centrifugal force is, okay? It's if you have a string and you tie it to a rock and you swing it and the rock goes out in a circle, right? That's centrifugal force. That's the outward flow. That's the unfoldment flow of energy, right? Give it a whirl. Yes, exactly. What people don't understand or haven't heard the word as often is centripetal energy. And that's the energy that's flowing inward. So if you look at it, you change your bathtub and you see it go into a swirl and it goes into the bathtub drain, it's going in a circle for sure, but it's not going out, it's going in. And that is centripetal vortex motion. So when we are loving, when we have a loving energy and we have it focused, we actually produce a centripetal energy vortex from our attention, which is very powerful when you think about it. It's like, you know, wow, you got a laser gun, you know, what are you going to do with it, you know? So that's when we're, again, back to the prayer thing, we're thinking loving thoughts towards that person, and we're literally feeding them that centripetal life-giving energy to them, which is very powerful to think about. However, this comes into what you were talking about how come we don't know this information. Well, hey, it would be in the interest of some people for us not to be aware of this, except very, very lightly so, because centripetal energy is also how human systems function. So it kind of goes like this. If you decide to watch a play, right, and I've been a performer, I've been a music performer and a theatrical performer, and we will talk amongst themselves, oh, gosh, we're getting such great energy from the audience, okay. What is happening is we have put everybody in seats and we've turned out all the lights around them and we have put lights on the stage and we've now directed that human energy toward the stage and toward the players and toward the story, right? It's theater, right? We've directed them, and we as people on the stage can feel that. We can feel when they're bored. You know, we can feel when they're mad. We can feel when they're excited. You know, sometimes you have audiences that are just blank, you know, like they're not laughing at the jokes. They're not, you know. And, you know, they're kind of half-hearted clapping. We can feel that as well, even though we can't even see them. We got light shining in our eyes, and we can't even see them. So that's what we're talking about, is that energy of attention coming toward the players. And it's an important energy for performance to be aware of again. Well, that comes to the concept of theatrics. I break the word down, theatrics. Theo-tricks. Theo meaning God, and tricks meaning tricks, right? So hierarchical religions that have powerful systems of control and money and all those things, I'm not going to say who, you can pick who you want to think about right there, use theater principles just the same as when you're going to a play. They use theatrical principles to draw human attention toward them so that they can make you think that they're important, so you can make you convince yourself that that's important. You convince yourself that that's spiritual. You convince yourself that that's relevant. And that's the word here. Attention, the attention equals love, equals centripetal energy, equals relevance, equals value, and it creates cohesion, because remember, it's pulling energy in, and it actually creates the cohesion of the religion. because all religion or politics, even politicians do this as well, it's a thought form construct. It's something that's in our mind that we think is real. You know, it's something that we believe is real. And this is used in politics, it's used in religion, and it's used in television and in media. Is they're getting the masses to look at them so that we feed them our attention energy and we convince ourselves that that's relevant and important. That's a huge principle to realize. It's huge. This is powerful to know that. Because if you know that, then you, if you're a person who wants to do positive things and you're bombarded with negative imagery and messages all around you, and you know that, you have empowered yourself to withdraw your energy, literally, from all of those distractions, pull that energy back, and decide what you want to pay attention to, what's important to you. That's a huge, huge principle. So the Theo tricks, the God tricks, if you notice, is in media, is color, sound, music, costuming, lighting, people being very dramatic in their movements, action sequences, like when you're watching movies, right, and you get totally lost in the movie and 2 hours goes by and you've eaten two bags of popcorn and you don't even know what happened, right? That same thing is being used by human systems. You know, if you see a pageant of some particular religion or another, that's the same thing. Color, music, costumes, affected movement in the leader, again, to draw attention to that spiritual experience. It's not a bad thing. It's used in any kind of ritual. So it's not necessarily bad. You get to decide if it's bad or good.
It's not bad. I mean, it's very effective. Like you're talking in theater and ritual, I mean, it's very effective. I just do want to say that Ken did join us now.
Hey, Kitty.
Hi, guys. Sorry. I'm coming back to Earth in a very slow process. So just hi. Yeah.
Oh, good. Well,
there is so much to talk about the past month. I don't even know where you guys are at right now, and I don't want to interrupt, but catch me up. And then if you're interested in the craziness that went down for the past 4 weeks out here,
I'll go through all of my stuff quick, and we'll find out. I'm anxious to find out.
Awesome. Awesome.
All right, but let Karen finish about the human attention.
Yeah, please.
And then we'll get into what's been going on. Yeah, cool.
Okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit more about the quantum hologram. And one of the resources, and if anybody's interested, I have a Facebook group for this. One of the resources I found was a group, and this would be one of my teachers, and he unfortunately passed away last year. So I and some others have been trying to gather up all the documents so that we can share those with each other. It was from a group. It was rather clandestine, and it was called the Life Physics Group. And basically, the gentleman was named A.R. Borden, and he's a controversial figure, so I'm not going to get too much into that part of it, but he did. The information was very compelling because it kind of explained more of this science behind the quantum hologram. There's other resources as well, but this was the one I kind of knew the most about. And one of the papers that was written was called let me get my little notes back here, Ideomaterial Physics. So it's kind of a subgenre of quantum physics. And the word is very interesting, ideomaterial, idea, matter. Ideo means idea, and material means matter. So going back to watching Shrek run through the forest in a Pixar movie, which everyone who is a little kid knows about that, okay, is that the idea that there's information connected to matter, ideomaterial. So the best way I know how to explain it is, if you look at that Pixar character, Shrek, he's a big green ogre, and someone had to make him out of computer bits and bytes. They had to define what color he was going to be and how tall he was going to be inside his environment and how did he move, and he's, you know, kind of big and lumbery and all of that stuff. Well, I kind of was in the early parts of video gaming, so this is also true of video games as well. I was learning computer science in the early part of video gaming. And so basically, the Shrek character, or any character in a video game, is got a program. He has a program that defines what color he is and how tall he is and what he looks like and all of that. And that's that program, and you can take that program and you can move him to the forest program, which defines the environment, or you can move him to the city program. And that's how video games and movies and stuff are done. They're very good examples of the quantum hologram that we were talking about, this case, a being, an ogre, loping through the computer-generated forest, right, on his adventures. And that's that idea, is that he's material in his world as a green ogre. That's the material part of him in his environment. But he's an idea. He's written out code. You could probably print out pages and pages of the Shrek code somewhere. I don't know if it's out there. But anyway, it's probably a secret because it's Disney. But anyway, that's the idea. The idea is the program and the words describing him. And the material part is, what does he look like and how does he act and move in his environment? So it's very fascinating that there's a physics that's exploring not just how does something move around in its environment, like bits and bytes and atoms and molecules and whatnot, but that there's also a way to look at the program behind each object. I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that what people often talk about, the Akashic Record, is not really like a library with books. It actually might actually be more like a computer program. So when someone is psychic, and they, some people can do this, they can pick up an object and they'll close their eyes and they'll know a little bit about who used to own it or how it was made, right? They start to get information. This was owned by a lady with black hair, and she wore a red dress, and she, you know, what's going on right there is that psychic person is reading the information file. You know, when in the old days of programs, we all had a README file, right? They're reading that file about that object. It's not just a locket or a ring or something like that. It also was owned by someone because some of that person's energy, because they wore it all the time, imprinted on the object, and they're reading that. They loved, again, back to attention engine, they just love that ring. It was their wedding ring, and they wore it every day. And they loved it. So they imprinted, actually, information using that attention thing I'm talking about onto the object. And then many years later, a psychic picks it up and can read some of that.
Oh, my God. You are hitting my last 4 weeks. Keep going. Jeez, this is insane.
So anyway, I'm going to be giving this talk on Wednesday, talking about the power of human attention. Like I said, I have all these kind of interesting alternative fringe science kind of guys that I've learned from. And I'm going to be sharing that in Texarkana. And I want to talk about one last part of this, and that way we can catch up with Ken and everything. I wanted to talk about POV, point of view. And this is very interesting because this term kind of got bandied about in these circles. What is your point of view? And I wrote a long time ago, I wrote an article about this, but I'll try to explain it. A point of view is where your focus is at, used in this context, not just your point of view, like what's your opinion on the latest election or politician. This has to do with what do you have your attention engine, your focus on? And there's four levels of this, and this is actually used in some neuroscience types of things for people who are with sports and things like that. To train an athlete, hey, if you're a pitcher and you're going to throw a baseball, you don't want to be paying attention to the person with pink cotton candy in the stands behind you. Your attention is going to be distracted from trying to get the ball across the plate into the catcher's mitt. You want to have that be your attention. So this has been taught in that sort of environment. Your POV has four stages to it. It has narrow, external. So that would be like if you look at your hand, you know, you get a splinter in your hand and you look at your hand and you're going to pick that splinter out. That's narrow external point of view, okay? And you want to be really careful, so you're going to be really paying attention. Other times, you'd be out on a mountain, cliff or something, look at a beautiful valley and it's just as far as the eye can see. That is broad, external. So it's internal, external, broad, or narrow. Those are the four terms. Narrow, external is your hand. Broad, external is the scenery and your environment and the things around you. And the other way we go is we go internal. So we have narrow, internal. So if you're laying there and you're trying to go to sleep and your stomach's growling because you need to eat a sandwich, that would be kind of the level of POV that you're working at, is that you're very aware of your body internally. You're kind of looking inside yourself. Or if you're having a memory or something kind of inside yourself having to do with your immediate, like what your thoughts are, that would be your internal, narrow internal point of view, right? And we kind of trade around with those three most of the time. Most of the time we're doing one of those three. But there's a fourth one. And this is really, really important to also look into in esoteric material and also in psychic things if you want to improve your ability to do all of this. It's also the suppressed area. It's the area that the powers that be don't want us to focus in on too much because we might know too much. And it's the broad internal point of view. And that's very fascinating because if you do meditate and whatnot, you start to poke around into that part of it. There's active meditation and there's passive meditation, and a lot of times people are just trying to focus on their breathing and things that, you know, like that. But sometimes when you're meditating, you'll have images and ideas and thoughts and sometimes information. Some people might actually see the future. They often do that in dreams and whatnot. That's when you've kind of plugged into the information stream of life, right? The broad internal is actually when you connect with source, is people understand that spiritually, or all that is, all the things are. So that's when you can really tune in on all the things like have visions of a future place you're going to be, or even if you have deja vu and you felt like you've been there before, or if you have an urgent feeling that somebody in your family is at risk or sick, or you get that sort of feeling, you know, that oh, something's going to happen, I better call somebody. You've plugged into that broad internal, like, internet, I-N-N-E-R-N-E-T, internet, right? And right. You're receiving information. And that's where your point of view is right then focused on the inside where, you know, everything's there, right? That's what the esoteric teachings teach us, is that world within, that everything that you need is within you. So that is my talk for Wednesday I'm going to be doing. I'm super glad to share it with everybody. And if anyone wants to contact me, if they live in the Texarkana area and wants to come, I'm on Facebook, and it's a www.facebook.com/KCPatrick1. Get a hold of me, and I'll tell you where to go, or if you want some information from what I just talked about, I would be glad to share any links anyone was interested in. So that's my talk I'm going to be doing Wednesday, and I'm super glad to share it with you guys.
Great. There were a couple of things I wanted to mention. The when you're talking about, like, the energy patterns lingering, you know, this is what we have, not just around items, but locations also. And I have
Oh, man, I can't wait.
Do a lot of
paranormal
things, and you know that they're really tuned into that. My other commentary was just going to be that when you're talking about focusing in on somebody, you know, earlier we were talking about eyes behind your back kind of thing. I think what we can all learn from, if you have any felines in your household, good. You know, people will do this too. You know, you're laying down somewhere, and all of a sudden you wake up, and somebody is just intently staring at you. They've woken you up. And my felines will do that. And it's not that I can necessarily see them unless I, you know, turn my head. They may be sitting behind me. But they will wake me up when it's time. We have a morning ritual. And if I'm trying to sleep late, it doesn't matter because they will wake me. So we can learn from them. But thank you, Karen, because that is, I know this was a shortened version, and you're doing this at the Casey and a group, Edgar Casey group,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, there's a very active Edgar Casey group I found out here, and I've been very excited. I've met some wonderful people, and they're always looking for speakers, and they found out Brett and myself you know, do speaking and have topics. And so they, and he can't be here tonight too, by the way. But anyway, he sends his regards. But basically, that's what, so I'll be doing that. And people contact me on Facebook at facebook.com/CaseyPatrick1. I'll give them information if they want to come. Plus, if they had any questions or wanted links from what I talked about, I'll be glad to share that.
Okay, great, great, great. You'll let us know how it comes out, but I know it's going to be great. So thanks so much for that.
Yeah,
you're making me rethink some things, so that's always good. I appreciate that. Okay, Ken, you wanted to tell us about your last 4 weeks.
Oh, my God. Well, first off, you hit the whole damn thing on the head.
Speaking of dramatic.
Yeah, you had like a that was like a giant sledgehammer smacking a tiny nail. You totally hit it on the head what I went through for 4 weeks or 3 weeks. It's first off, you guys know about my property, what I found out here. I've been doing a lot of research on it, and it is definitely a Hopewell Spiritual Center at one time.
Mm.
Now, when you were going into inner space, I've done some ayahuasca, you know, DMT psilocybin journeys and stuff, digging into this, meditated, brought psychics out here, clairvoyance, everything. And it's always, always, always had insanely high results. I learned about perspective, which was the term I was using, versus point of view. They're the same thing. You were hitting that on the head. I know I spent 3 weeks with somebody who died and now tapped source. But their baggage and all their emotion clouded their read. They read emotion. But if they were screwing their read up, but they were tapping source, I helped them decipher that for 3 weeks. Now, this is in a house where, like, you wake up in the middle of the night hearing your own voice screaming, and it wakes you up. I'm serious. I thought it was my son, Henry. Realize that my bed is against, the room has two doors, our bedroom. The door is where my head is. It picked up all of my emotion over the last 7 years. We had Angel out. Angel is one of the people that came out. And I had two people go through and clean this house and property.
Good. Yeah, good.
Oh, my God. You guys don't. It's insane. Like, I woke up to my own yelling in my head.
Wow.
It scared me. Like, I sat up and I heard all the. Me and Julie went through a huge, huge thing. Like, just. Dude, I have never had a relationship cleansed before, and nobody knew they were cleaning it. None of us. It just happened. And this is after we found out that the house, this used to be Hopewell territory, and it's on a giant bed of iron right next to the Great Lakes, which is the largest freshwater ocean on the planet, and this is where all the Native Americans in the Midwest would meet to settle differences. And we were like, I knew it wasn't that they just picked an area. It wasn't like going to Vegas, you know, like, hey, we'll just build this shit out here. No, it was already had the energy to do it. It's an amplifier. There are three other properties we found with the same stuff. I have a vortex on this property. It's been validated by more seers than you can imagine. And there's math under the site. Crazy math, you know, that blew me away with cardinal points and everything. I uncovered it. It was like Stir of Echoes. I woke up one night, had to dig this up. I don't know, you guys probably know that story. So, like, we go back into this spot. When we come to find out, the Freemasons came here 200 years ago and founded the town. They bought it from the Potawatomi. The Potawatomi basically sold land. They didn't own. This was a spiritual center. It was probably a 30-mile circle that was between the Kankakee River and the Great Lakes, Lake Michigan. And what it created was a moraine, which was just like a giant food forest prairie. And they designed the food forest with different types of trees and plants so that you never had to garden. Food was always there, and it brought the animals, too. Well, that's what I'm standing. I'm outside right now standing in it. And the spot we found is in the very center of all this. You go out there, and, like, you'll get visited. I've seen energetic forms. I have had animals hang out with me, squirrels, raccoons, possums, toads, birds, sit with me for hours. I'll go out there and meditate. I've done my weird shamanic crap out in there. I built this hut to do it in, and things will come and hang out with you. Bugs will land on you and just sit with you for, like, long. Like, they'll walk around the yard with you on your shoulders and stuff. It is insane. Like this year we have so many frogs and toads on the ground that you're stepping on them as you're walking. And it's no joke, everyone's witnesses. Ask Angel if you guys feel like we get him back on, man. Oh, because he stayed for a week. He's coming back again, and he's looking at, I need to be there for like 6 months. We got to work. Because all these properties where the people were, the amplification of the energy, if applied negatively, amplified
yeah.
negatively.
Yeah.
Every single property has a natural clairvoyant living on it right now for no good reason, but they were attracted
yeah.
to that property. Generational natural clairvoyant. Generational.
Yeah.
And their abilities got heightened due to the energy on the place.
Yeah.
Angel didn't know he was a healer at the level he is. He didn't know how he read people. He didn't know what he could do till he got here. Same with Kara.
Wow.
Kara's still wow. here. She's probably she's going in about 5 days. Insane.
She's never really seen. She's staying a lot longer than she planned.
She only planned to stay 2 weeks.
Right.
That was a universe thing. That was definitely not in the mix. She didn't go, I got to stay longer. It was, oh, that's the ticket I got. Whoa, okay. And it all panned out. Like, the way things unfolded was insane. She tapped source. She can hear it, but she can't discern it because think of it like this. Source is basically a giant soup of probabilities. Every possible
yeah.
past, future, and peripheral life moment of observation you have is in source for everything, every bit of quantum particle. And then this is what I figured out by watching her work and Angel, me and him just brainstorming constantly and reading everything, constantly going through this. What we found is that when you tap it, the Akashic Record is basically what you would call your most probable past of which you were in. The things that had the heaviest weight of existence. If, for instance, like getting into, say, demonology, a demon basically is just this. It is this collection of negative consciousness that's vampiric. It does not go with flow. It impedes flow. It sucks. So then you've got that energy out there. And
yeah.
you have, let's say, a culture who, if you look at, like, the Book of Solomon, not the biblical book, but his books, you know, and
yeah.
you get into the Gotha.
The Greater
and
Keys
he was,
of Solomon and the Lesser Keys of Solomon.
The Greater Key, thank you. Okay, all right, so you go through those and you start and you pick one. And then you go through mythology and you look at what it embodied in the stories they told. And we'll just, we don't need any in particular. We'll say one was mostly a gluttonous creature. It's fed on the gluttony of the culture. And then people then embody it. It then takes on that vibration. The vibration is now its name. When you look at fairies, leprechauns, any non-corporeal, non-human entity, knowing its name, like Hellboy, let's watch Hellboy, and tell me that knowing his name didn't lock him in a spell, you know, lock him up. You control them. Well, the whole point is because you know the vibration. Now, vibration... Well, you know, that's just basic, that's energy. Then if you can utter the sound, you have now vibrated matter, matter being energy. You just were walking through this, you know, just like 5 minutes ago. So we're watching this in action out here, literally watching it in action. Everything was changing, and they're getting into these other families with all this crazy stuff that went on, and we're all involved in this and working on it. And... there, we realized, like, going back now, we're going to get back to my property because I got it straight. So the Freemasons came here. Well, I was reading a book on the Knights Templar Freemasons and founding America and stuff, and what they did, this is, in theory, King Solomon's mines are in the Northeast Coast. In theory, they've been coming here thousands of years, you know, and I believe it just because all the cultures have. Well, when they came here, we're the Americas in general. Is a very high energy point. And I'm going to get real goofy with you. The Mayan culture talks about how 12,000 years ago an asteroid hit and flooded an island in the Gulf of Mexico they called Atlantis. The Mayans say that that's where they came from. That is in Mayan lore. Humboldt's man, he's one of the carriers of the knowledge, says this. This is standard, you know, you can, Drumvalo Melchizedek follows him around, and he actually also talks about it. Explains it very cleanly. Well, the Tibetans The Mayans, the Hopi, all these people were all offshoots. It took 200 years to flood this island. It took 200 years to flood everything, the Great Flood story, 12,000 years ago. Now go back and look at the Ilitara and all these cultures, the Dogon, they all talk about it being around that era. So then what they did, the Atlanteans sent all their priests and all their people off over the course of 200 years to spread to better areas. Well, here we go. You got the Hopi. They're up in, you know, southern America, you know, like around by you, Karen, you know, and stuff. And then
Arizona,
the Hopewell,
New Mexico.
Yeah. Yeah, Angel's working with them now, which, by the way, you got some really neat.
Kenny, I got to ask a question if I could, though, very quick.
What was that?
You said I want to ask a very, very quick question. The Potawatomi, are they all related to the Algonquins and the Potawatomi?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
They
well,
are.
Well,
from what I could tell, I've been doing a lot of research.
You and I need to talk about that.
Because you probably got a link. I'm trying to put together why they did this. But here's what occurred was the Hopewell, the mound builders, you know, all the mounds
in
North America,
yes.
They're built, well, and in Indiana and in Illinois. They were built,
yes.
Serpent
and
Mound, all
Ohio,
this stuff was all built.
I think. Doesn't
That's
Ohio?
Right. Ohio. And Pennsylvania too, but they and Michigan, they built all these spiritual structures. They're known for it. They also, this is the knowledge they took from the Mayans and Hopi, which now going by Mayan lore, offshoots of Aztec culture. They carried the same teachings, the Vedics, that the Celts, that every you know the Dogon. All of these, Tibetans, like everybody teaches the same rough construct.
Yeah.
Everything you're talking about with the video game concept, which has been my standard for a year, I threw it on Angel. He crapped his pants. Because I don't know if we ever talked about it, but you're dead on what I've been, like, basically theorizing, you know, in conversation and stuff. So anyways, these guys been teaching this stuff. They also, remember, they watch the stars, especially Cygnus and Sirius. Now, there's a whole long thing I don't even want to get into with those two, but the fact was all these cultures watched it, the Egyptians, everybody. So you got this. They're building these structures. Now you've got this. They don't build them arbitrarily because if they knew the stars, they knew the knowledge to follow energy, divine out energetic areas, which takes running fresh water, takes...
Yeah.
A core of iron, because what does every culture say about iron? It keeps away bad spirits, rusty iron, the true form of iron, not steel, not wrought iron. True iron is rust. True iron is rust. So rusty iron, there is a component in it that does not allow for, I would call, vampiristic vibrations, vibrations that pull but do not go with flow. Now that, wherever you got large deposits, you're going to have a sort of amplification. And I have a feeling that that's where you're getting these vortexes. That's where you're getting these energy centers, basically. And then how they're used is another thing. But I think that the Templars, Freemasons, and all these people came here. They founded America. I mean, you can go back. I'm preaching to the choir here, but they founded this country. And they created Manifest Destiny. They created the Smithsonian to cover all these cultures that were already here teaching extremely technological things, you know, high-end technology, stuff that, because it's not, you know, it doesn't have gears and circuits. Well, yeah, they had that too, but anyways, it was more biological. And so they're teaching this, and they're operating. They live in food forests. I'm standing in one, once again. I haven't planted a damn thing on this property, and I got more food than my family could ever eat, let alone the neighborhood. I'm serious. Everything around me is medicinal and food. I didn't do anything. I mowed a path. This keeps coming back because what they did is they designed a system with plants that are not just perennial, but they self-mitigate. They do their own work. Nobody does anything. The birds, the butterflies, the bees, the frogs, the plants, the whole ecosystem. It's insane, and this is what the entire moraine was like. And they set that up, and then the energy in the place went positive because I lived here when it was negative. It took me years to get this. When it was negative, I had no butterflies. I had no bees. There were barely any frogs, and half the plant life here was not here. We started cleaning and changing the use of the property and the energy of people, allow who comes and who goes, and what we put into it. That's it. And every year,
wow,
it got better and better. This year, it's insane. And it was like it was ready for what we just did. And so then you got these people now. They know, the Freemasons, you know, the secret societies, know to follow the secret. Back then they weren't secret cultures. The Hopewell and stuff, this was a very prominent culture. They knew to follow them to find their citadels, their structures, and their math and their mechanics,
yeah,
the spiritual centers. They went to them. There's gold there. We know about that. So let's assume there was gold here, because I know that Valpo, there's a running theory that there's gold under the courthouse out there. So the town I'm in, Valparaiso. So, you know, it's got crazy history too. But the key thing was these three Freemasons came here, or two Freemasons, and originally founded. Then more people came. It's just like Rockwall, Texas. They bought it from the Potawatomi. They took over the place. I am on a 200-year-old farm, one of the first properties in this region, probably one of the scouted properties. I'm like 10 minutes outside of the center of town. It is a heavy Lutheran and Freemason town. Our Valpo University is a Lutheran university. When you look at the documentary for the guy that found out all the stuff with Rockwall, Texas, he said, look for a courthouse across the street from a Freemason lodge and look for a police station nearby and look for old money. That's everything I'm living in right now. That's what this whole area is. And so then we come back to this property, and there's all this energy. The house, craziest part now, this thing was a 200-acre farm. He came here. The guy that built it in a way that you don't build houses, especially in the Midwest, and that is they do them on cardinal grid work. This house, the corners of the house are the cardinal points. One. Two. Two clairvoyants picked up that the guy messed with dark magic. So then he then had a child. This child was tortured, messed up, and cycled the abuse and the dark magic. So what he had done was he literally brought kids in and murdered them and people in the basement. And we're picking it up through the chimney. It's a clay basement. It's clay and brick. The chimney goes all the way through the house. There's a portal going through there. It's like a siphon, you know. It's insane. And that was affecting everybody in the house. I mean, I've had, like, people, it's documented, prior to us living there, people going insane in the house. The last owner had a wife go insane, had a roommate that rented the attic where, you know, I got my office and stuff, where we did a lot of the work, go nuts. Two people within 20 years, and kids screaming, you get them out of the house, they're not screaming, waking up with nightmares every night. You know, and the more sensitive the people are, the crazier it got. So what we found was this guy, now the son of the guy that built the house, he basically had a son and a daughter. We can only find, I think there was another daughter too, but the cemetery is like a quarter mile from here of the house. So everyone that lived in the house, that died in the house, even as a laying out room, like it's full on old farmhouse. The cemetery plots are over there, and you can find everybody from the first person that lived in the house. But there is a missing kid that two people picked up. And many other people picked her up, but two people were able to really nail it. And the cool thing was I never gave the information to any of them. There were seven separate people that picked up on the little girl. There were two people that picked up on the brother. But the crazy thing was, and this is all Kara that, like, figured out the first part, and then we deduced the rest, this guy Josiah basically killed his daughter, raped and killed her, opened a portal, and then buried her in the backyard. And all the negative energy, he kills himself in the house, too.
Well, yeah, that doesn't go away on its own. When dreadful things have happened, that energy is still around.
The memories. You hit it when you were talking about objects and buildings. This
right.
House.
But we only have. We've got 40 seconds left. So,
oh my God, man.
We'll be back next Monday. And Karen, have a wonderful talk Wednesday.
Yes, please.
That's cool.
I'm not going to talk to you guys separately about this because we can finish it on the show. But you remember where we left off, please.
Right.
Josiah, the little girl.
Body in the back.
I have a... Oh my God, it gets crazier. That's the base. I love you guys.
Love you. Bye.
Bye.